You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. The DJ tonight was our marvelous Lene Denise, who's also a writer and scholar. Our panel moderator is Tisa Bryant, who teaches at CalArts, is the author of Unexplained Presence, a collection of essays on myth-making and Black presences in film, literature, and visual art. Author Nisi Shawl, here from Seattle, was a close friend of Octavia's during her years in that rainy city. With Cynthia Ward, she co-authored Writing the Other, A Practical Approach, and she is the editor of Blood Children, Stories by the Octavia E. Butler Scholars. Award-winning poet Douglas Kearney, who grew up in Altadena, not far from where Octavia grew up, has a new collection of writing on poets and performativity titled Mess and Mess and. He teaches at CalArts. Ayanna A.H. Jameson is the founder of the Los Angeles-based Octavia E. Butler Legacy Network. She was one of the organizers of Ferguson is the Future, incubating alternative worlds through arts, activism, and scholarship symposium at Princeton, and she's currently working on Octavia Butler's biography. And arts educator and independent filmmaker Ben Caldwell is the founder of Chaos Network, a community arts center in Leimert Park that provides training on digital arts, media arts, and multimedia. His films often trace historical and cultural connections, and as I witnessed this week, Ben also has extrasensory powers, so never know what's going to happen tonight. I'm now going to turn the podium over to Julia Meltzer, who's the founder at Clock Shop, one of the most terrific and inventive curators in town, and she'll tell you more about their fantastic year-long project. Please welcome Julia Meltzer.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Julia Meltzer. A little bit about Clock Shop. Clock Shop is an arts organization that commissions artists and writers to make new work. We also curate and produce projects and events. We have a space in Frogtown along the LA River, and we also work off-site in partnership with other larger institutions. We are thrilled to present Radio Imagination, a year-long program honoring the work of Octavia E. Butler. Last month was the 10-year anniversary of her death. The title, Radio Imagination, references a quote from Butler, which goes, "I have the type of imagination that hears. I think of it as radio imagination." Reading Butler's work has been a life-changing experience for so many writers and artists. We created this program to honor an exceptional trailblazer, who was also a Los Angelino, and to track the influence she's had on the next generations of writers, artists, and thinkers. This project took shape because we knew that the Huntington Library in Pasadena had Butler's papers, which were made available to researchers in 2013. We approached the Huntington with a request that they grant readers' passes to a curated group of artists and writers who would be part of Radio Imagination. The Huntington graciously agreed and are now one of our most significant partners. With funding from the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Philip and Muriel Berman Foundation, and the Pasadena Art Alliance, we've been fortunate to commission 8 artists and 4 writers to create new work based on Butler's archives. These archives are rich, expansive, and deep, as you probably saw some of the examples in the images before the show. We anticipate that great work will come out of this opportunity. An exhibition of all the projects commissioned will take place at the Armory Center for the Arts in Pasadena in October 2016. And please pick up one of these postcards outside to see the full program. Throughout the year and leading up to the exhibition and beyond are many public events. We hope you'll check out the full calendar. If you'd like to support the program, please buy a tote bag after this discussion. 50% of the proceeds from the tote bags will be donated to the Octavia E. Butler Memorial Scholarship Fund, which brings young writers of color to the Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Workshop. This writing workshop gave Butler her boost into publishing. Please help support the next generation of writers. Finally, I'd like to extend sincere thanks to Louise Steinman and her staff at the Library Foundation. Thank you. I myself am a dedicated member of the Foundation, and I encourage you all to join if you're not members, and I frequently attend these events, and I value the space that has been created here, free access to great writers and ideas. Louise and I began the conversation about this program more than a year ago, and so it's finally great to be here and to welcome you all to this program. And with that, we'll open with one of the short videos that Clockshop produced for this series.
Has it been difficult for you?
I think I had one choice. Well, two choices. I could become a writer, or I could die really young.
I got to live a 19th century existence for a little while. My grandmother had a chicken ranch, and there was no electricity, and the well for water, that kind of thing. We told stories.
She grew up in a very strict Baptist background. She often said that writing was one of the few things that didn't seem to be forbidden in her religion that was still fun.
I have a book called Kindred. My character is a new writer, and she has lots of horrible little jobs, cleaning, warehouse, factory, office, all jobs I'd done. I mean, some that I didn't even put in because they were just so bad.
When I came into the field, you know, Chip Delaney and Octavia and I were pretty much it. She would write about black people in her books, and they would put green people on the cover.
The guy next to me was an editor, and he said he thought that it wasn't really necessary to have black characters in science fiction, because you could always make any racial statement you needed to make by way of extraterrestrials.
It's hard to be somebody like Octavia, who says, every single day I'm going to labor alone, doing battle with the demons in my head for a goal that the whole world thinks I cannot have.
Instructed to call her up, but she just came out. Tisa Bryant, welcome.
A little icebreaker. Hey, okay. Thank you for being here. Good evening. It's so great to see you. Thank you all for being here tonight in remembrance of Octavia Butler. As you heard, this is the 10th year of her being an ancestor. And we will take the entire year celebrating her life and work, and beyond that, of course. But this is a really great opportunity to be really immersed in what it meant to have her here from LA. And it's also really important that we're here at the LA Public Library, as much of Octavia Butler's writing, as you may have noticed in the slideshow, so much of her work, her writing, and her research occurred right here in this building. She spent a lot of time here, so it's really special that we're gathered to think about what she did. I'm really grateful to Louise Steinman, Sarah Charlton, Jen Dees, who did so much work to make this happen, and Julia Meltzer, without whom this whole adventure wouldn't be commencing now. So thank you so much, Julia, for including me. As one of the writers commissioned by Clockshop to work with Octavia Butler's papers at the Huntington Library, I'm humbled to experience the thinking alongside such a committed, focused, and talented, compassionate woman as Octavia Butler. Her vision and deep engagement with the world of science, technology, human relationships, and writing opens my eyes and mind wider every day. I didn't expect to gain an advisor, a mentor, a stern, staunch, but playful supporter in my researching her self-formation and really reinvestigating and expanding my own self-formation, that it's always a process. And it's been so, I can't even begin to express what it means to kind of feel her presence, like she's here when I'm reading her words. And it's such a gift. And a pleasure and a privilege to experience her conjured through her writings, and I'm so excited to mingle with these open channels of creativity and thought with our panelists tonight. In their book, Strange Matings, Science Fiction, Feminism, African American Voices, and Octavia E. Butler, Rebecca J. Holden and Niecy Shaw dedicate the book for Octavia and for all those who knew and loved her and all those who wish they had. In that spirit, I dedicate this evening to Octavia E. Butler, to all those here who knew her, and all those who wish they had. Our hope tonight is to bring us all a little bit closer to her and to her writing and thinking here in Los Angeles, and closer to each other. We've opened the space with beautiful music from Lene Denis, and also with Octavia's presence visually, and we'll do so a little bit more with the sound of her voice from an audio clip.
One of the main things I liked about the idea of coming here, I mean, aside from the fact that this library has practically been a second home to me for more than 20 years, the thing I liked was the title of this, Racing Toward the Millennium. And what I want to talk about today is what sort of people we are liable to be when we get there, when we pass that landmark or whatever, what sort of people we have been. In order to see who we are, we do have to take a look at who we've been.
And we'll open our conversation with the panelists with that thought in mind.
This is a libation for all good spirits who are here helping us to celebrate Octavia's life and work.
Ashe.
Ashe. Ashe.
Well, we're here now. And she's here now. Ben, Ayana, Niecy, and Doug, we're going to start the conversation. So the recording that we heard of Octavia was from 1998 here, perhaps in this room. In this room. Thank you, Louise. In this room, Racing Towards the Millennium. And the series was then called Voices of the American West, which then became Aloud. And I'd like to kind of open our conversation in asking all of the panelists here to share with us who you were when you first encountered Octavia Butler's writing and who you have become since that encounter because of it.
So that starts with me?
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Let's see, who I was when I first met her work was... I came back from Howard after teaching for 4 years, and an English teacher saw one of my scripts that I was doing called I Fresh, and she says, you need to look at this book, Wild Seed, because of the structure of your film. I looked at it. I was really hunting for more of a... the male character in there, Duro, was very scary to me. Yeah. I had to wrestle on what that individual meant and how he was doing, how he dealt with issues. Because in my film, I deal with spirits too, but the way that I try to deal with spirits is the more healing aspects, and it ended up being more of the female aspects of Mary that I found more at homeness with. So that was really the first time I got to meet her in that manner.
And do you want to say who have you become now?
I am Mary.
Anranu,
yes. No, but really, in a lot of ways, the whole idea of the spirit, the thing that I discovered with an African context, I saw them as Orishas, you know. And Orisha is both cultures. I mean, both sexes. So that was more of how I started really dealing with it. So I believe that the spirit that is behind that is all sexes. You know, it's the spirit that's watching our bodies. That's a neutral spirit.
Wow. I started to read her work during grad school when I was being assigned old dead psychologists who were theorizing about women and children and families and communities without perhaps any thought in mind of folks that look like me or communities that look like mine or the community that I needed. And so I was reading all of my assigned work, and I went into a Borders bookstore, and a copy of Dark Matter 2 was there with that orange cover, and it called to me. And there was a conversation in the back where she was talking about the second law of thermodynamics. And then I found Dark Matter 1, and then I read Parable of the Sower, and it was all over. I could not be otherwise. I was called toward change. And that's what a lot of my work in research and writing happens to be about. Change and community and folks that come from everywhere, that look like everything, that love like everyone, not just one thing, and someone that was alive and living and writing during my lifetime. It's really called me to want to document who we are now, the way that she documented herself.
Well, I will say that when I first read Octavia's work, I didn't know I was reading Octavia's work. I wrote about that in an essay, so I don't feel like I should just go over that ground again. But at the time, I was someone who had been reading science fiction for years and years, and had suddenly gotten the idea that I could also write it. And now I am someone who pretty much makes my living from writing science fiction.
I was a high school student at John Muir High School. And my mother actually gave me a copy of Wild Seed. And the first thing I, you know, remember about that, of course, was looking at the cover and seeing this sort of clash between the sort of poise of the silhouette, and then this like menagerie that was like growing out of the back of the skull. It was like a mutated Great Queens of Africa poster from like Budweiser or something like that. and the thing I remember was the cruelty of men. Of course, I'd, you know, read books, horror and fantasy and that kind of thing, but for some reason that cruelty always seemed like an operatic effect, right? But in Wild Seed, it was just, you weren't going to kind of get around it, you weren't going to triumph over it in any of the ways that I'd become accustomed to. If I have to say who I am now, I hope I am the type of person and writer who understands that as sort of taking out the sort of masculine lubrication of cruelty and heroism and confronting these just larger, almost seeming impassable structures of masculine cruelty and other forms of cruelty. So hopefully that's who I am now.
Wow. That's the thing about the opening question. You don't, it's like, now where do I go? I'm going to go where I plan to go. You know, I think so much about, I'm from the East Coast. I'm not an Angelina. I think I might be becoming an Angelina. Mm-hmm. I have to, I was told it would happen to me. and I'm really curious about your encounter with the West through the eyes of a Black woman science fiction writer. And I'm really thinking so much about the West because, you know, before space, the West was the final frontier, the strange place, the alien place, the conquerable place. And, you know, with Hollywood, too, you know, the West is becomes the landscape for other worlds and other planets in addition to where we actually are. And I wonder how Octavia Butler made your Los Angeles or the West that you knew to be real kind of recognizable to you, or conversely, if she made it a little unrecognizable. I'm really curious about what her citing her work here meant to people here to kind of see Southern California specifically.
You know, for me, I was reading some of the parts of her talking about how they had to live out in the desert for one portion of her life. And I'm a desert person myself. And I think one of the things that happens in the desert, because I was reflecting on some of the things that she was saying, and what happens in a place where there's no lights and it's just the sky and the moon, you have a 180 degrees view of space. And you really have a strong sense that you're on a capsule, a spaceship of a sort. I know I used to, as a kid, used to scare people by just turning out the lights and then watch the sky fall in on you, you know, because then you really see that you're this little tiny dot that's right in on this massive thing that's moving a million miles an hour. And you can really feel it, and it humbles you. So I think it makes you a space person in the beginning, you know, as a kind of, it makes you think in that kind of a way a lot more than people who are in the cities.
I have to say the first thing that came to mind when you said that was my parents were divorced, so I lived half of the time in Pasadena area and half of the time in Ontario. And the mountains, it's the mountains. Whenever I travel anywhere and it's flat, I feel completely unanchored. And in the parables, when they're walking on the 101, they're walking on the 5 freeway, and the mountains are there, it was like, oh my gosh, I know where Robledo is. Like, I mean, you know, I would go to work as a substitute teacher every morning and be like, these are my mountains, the ones that have cradled me for my whole life, right? And Octavia's riding them in. And that's where I live, in the foothills. So the reality of the books, right? Lauren being born in 2009, it's like we're living in the future right now, right? Talk about the final frontier, right? Like her reality is pushing up against my reality so that the veil between what's fiction and what is the physical space are actually blurred, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what I came to know in reading her work. And I can't live anywhere, right, without knowing where my mountains are, right? The way that she oriented herself on that journey. Mm-hmm. So.
I think about when I was younger, I thought of the frontier as the north. I thought I was always following the drinking gourd or going to Canada to escape the draft. I found myself in the West here, and that's when I physically met Octavia. And so what her writing set in the West means to me is that same sense of the frontier, which I transfer now from the North to beyond the now. That's where That's what her writing and her placing writing in the West means to me, is that conceptual frontier, mm-hmm. as opposed to just like wagons or my version, the drinking gourd.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when you grow up on the frontier, growing up in Altadena on Alameda Street, I remember I used to always look up at like that mountain range that was just the north, we were in the foothills, and I constantly had this sort of nightmare that like one day there was going to be this gigantic tidal wave that was just going to come over that range. I mean, like that range is like, it's like somebody took a picture of rocks and tore it, and just however it tears, the rest behind that was just blue. And so one day that was just going to dump down on me and like bury everything, and I was just going to stand there and watch it happen. So this kind of sense that if you get to the frontier, then there's nothing. Here be dragons. That's what's left. And so there's that starkness that you could use, I think, to describe her writing that I had to come to appreciate about the topography of this part of the state. And I'm constantly reminding people who, when they think, oh, nature, and they immediately think trees or a lot of green or a lake, I say, no, those rocks, that's nature as well. And then just the other bit about a more that was personal, of course, but even more personal, I think, was just the kind of constant sense that, oh, yeah, you know, Octavia Butler lives right around the corner. Like not really knowing where that was, but just kind of knowing that somewhere not far, like closer than like coming to downtown LA, Octavia Butler was someplace. And that was a really just kind of a powerful sort of anchor.
Wow. You know, my eye just went to that side wall and I just saw the mountains. And she really loved mountains. She writes about them quite a bit. And being from Boston, we have hills. We call them mountains.
Right.
We're scolded about that. Like, you don't know nothing about mountains. And it's true. And it's interesting when I have friends come to visit here, that feeling of the enormity of the darkness at night. I was with a poet friend driving on the 210 from CalArts back to my house. And she wasn't having a panic attack, but she felt like it could eat her. And I just didn't understand, like, oh, well, it's so beautiful. To me, it felt like it opened out, not that it closed in. But it's so wonderful to just imagine this place as outer space without leaving. Like, so much of Octavia Butler's work up until the Parable of the Talents, we're always here. Things come here in her work. But we're not necessarily leaving for another planet the way most science fiction would have us kind of transported into some other place. It's always a drawing to California. And she even said, I would feel most at home and comfortable in the desert or the city. Keep in mind, however, that I write to get out of myself. The people, though human and fallible, must be larger than life too, larger than my life. And the place may be now, but it may not ever be here. So it can always be now, but it may not ever be here. So this way of kind of keeping familiar and making strange, like having a kind of a futurity at the same time that we seem very anchored, is kind of like a magical thing that she's able to do in her work, and so informed by this landscape. And something that you said makes me want to kind of move into community and space, you know, that you could always run into Octavia Butler somewhere, and we were talking about this backstage, this encounter. So she was famously shy, called herself a hermit, but she got around, you know. She took public transportation, she knew people, she wasn't a shut-in And so I'm really curious about like how you met her and this kind of sense of her presence in your world. And I know that for Niecy, that was in Seattle and not in LA. But still quite important that she moved around and was not holed up in her house writing all the time.
Because she knew that was part of being a writer, was being available to people as a person, as well as a writer. She did her best to overcome her shyness. She took courses in it. Yeah, she really did. The first time I met her was when she was a guest of honor at Potlatch, which is a small science fiction convention in Seattle. She was living in L.A. at the time, but she came up and they asked me to write a program note about her. And I looked at her and I said, "Oh, you're much more beautiful than I thought you were." Which was true. I wasn't like, you know, trying to like, you know, oil her up or anything. But I guess she liked that because then she said we should go and have a chat. So, yeah. She made herself available to the public and she made herself available to me. So that was great. Yeah.
I mean, she came to Muir, my high school, which was also her alma mater, you know, as part of, it was probably in February, you know. right.
Black History. For those of you who don't know, that Black History Month.
Exactly.
Black Futures Month. Black Futures Month.
And you know, it was probably like my sophomore year, so probably the 1990 or so. And she came to present. So that's actually the closest I ever got to her that I knew, you know, that I knew about. But I just, you know, remember that presentation and telling my mother about it. I think that's when she gave me the book. That was just, I mean, it was cool. I mean, like, there's like a kind of a popular, there was in popular culture at that time, there was a rise in a kind of, you know, Black cultural nationalism. You know, whether you're talking about rap groups like Public Enemy or, you know, or even De La Soul or Tribe Called Quest. So we had a lot of this kind of recuperative, you know, Black history. And so for her to be a part of that and not like some kind of outlier of like, she does science fiction, but you know, we could talk about it. Cause like, she was just kind of like, as I remember, just a part of that. And that was, I feel really lucky that was how that encounter worked, that it wasn't kind of like, oh, and guess what? You know, but it was just sort of like, okay, you have this, you have this, you have Octavia Butler, you have these things. And so that encounter with her in that space and, you know, her being a graduate as well at that school was, it was important at that moment.
Yes, I got to meet her with through Beverly Robinson. She was a friend of mine that taught at UCLA. She tended to be a person that would draw in a lot of Black entertainers and performers. And she helped curate a show that was at William Grant Steele that dealt with her work. And that was in the 79, 80s. And Beverly asked me to give her a ride home. So that's how I...
say why she couldn't drive.
Yes, and so I gave her a ride home and we got to talk. My film at the time was called I and I, and it was about a visitation of an African spirit to this country. And so I think that was part of the reason they were thinking we should have some sense of an alignment in working with each other. And then the bottom fell out of Los Angeles' art scene, and I moved to Howard. So when I moved to Howard, I ended up having another focus. But then, like I said, as soon as I came back, the first book that was offered was her book, and saying that you guys should know each other, and the works are very pretty similar. So that's how I got to meet her.
I have to say, sadly, I didn't get to meet her. But the degrees of separation were like half of one, right? Not even a whole separation. And she didn't drive, so she took the bus. And growing up, I would see this very striking, tall, imposing woman, like, waiting for the bus as I was being, you know, ferried back and forth between my brother's soccer games and to the hair salon my stepmother owned and things like that. And going in and out of the grocery store and things like that. But when I was an adult, right, I knew someone who had been a reporter for the LA Times and the LA Weekly, and he would tell me all the time, like, oh, I went to Octavia Butler's house, and here's this story, and she had this in her living room, and I was still saying, yeah, yeah, whatever, right? The universe was saying, like, come on, you know, Ayana, wake up. And I just kept sort of shrugging it off. So I heard all of these stories out of context, right? Not realizing that I had read her and that I knew who it was. Mm-hmm. And she said that she didn't read fast enough and that that's why she didn't think driving a car would be a good idea. So when...
The signs, yeah.
Yeah, the road signs and the traffic and things like that, which is very practical. When you think about the way that you encounter the world as a pedestrian rather than the way that most Angelenos encounter the world from inside your car, which is this box where it's your own little universe and your own little ego and consciousness inside of this box. So she was really with people in collective and communal spaces without necessarily being in relationship with them. Mm-hmm. So like the circumstantial communities, which is what brought on speech sounds. And I want to talk a little bit about the aspects that people don't realize. So you're talking about 1990. Who remembers, can someone tell me, which proposition is it? Was it 209 or 108 that was supposed to exclude anyone who was undocumented from getting public? 187. I was in high school at the time. 187 sparked Parable of the Talent, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talent. When you look in the archives, you see references to Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev and Pete Wilson and all of these California political figures. So it's not just that she's writing about the mountains. Right. It's not just that she's writing about people. It's not just that she's talking about the desert. She's talking about the actual political, geopolitical history that we share, right? And where I live now in Monrovia, actually that wicked little piece of unconstitutional legislation came out of there, and they introduced it in the California legislature, and it didn't go anywhere. So then they made it a ballot initiative, and then all the bigoted folks, the same people that voted for the defense of marriage and all this other stuff, those people voted that into law, right? And it was deemed unconstitutional. But if you see, this is something that is in our collective memory that sparked an entire movement, right? Not just a book. And people don't necessarily realize that this state has had more laws on the books for Jim Crow than any other state in the union. You know, we were denying people from the very beginnings up until now, right? So this is these are the circumstances in which she was writing, and her mother was a maid, so they lived in a house where they were the hired help and they didn't have a home of their own. This is a very different landscape than the narrative that is often told, that's been told up to this point, right? The shining, transcendent hero that comes back to the high school. Like, no, people, and I knew someone that went to high school with her. People knew that her family, that her family was domestics. Mm-hmm. So that's a very different sort of working class background. Mm-hmm. So her feminism was, you know, cellular, right? Mm-hmm. Like in her DNA, not something that she read in a book.
Right.
Her intersectionality was there before we had a term for it.
Right. I mean, and the insistence on change as being, I mean, like all of those kinds of measures, all the walled cities, all the lack of access, the fact that we're just now building this, you know, the train to DC or whatever, you know, is about a kind of a prophylactic against change, a kind of a homogeneity. Let's keep it that way. And so the insistence on change and transformation that drives so much of the work as a strategy.
As an independent, autonomous thing that moves on its own whether you like it or
whether
not.
Whether you like it or not, right?
Yeah.
Nisi, can I ask you about the Orisha that has to do with change in Oya?
Sure.
Because that's in her work all the way through, even before she named it, but you know more about it.
Well, the Orisha that's associated with change in my mind is Oya, and so she did call one of her characters Lauren Oya Olamina, and she did talk about change as a religious and philosophical force in the world, right? So, but as you say, it was well before that she was interested in change as a constant, and pretty much the only constant.
I have a couple of things to say, but one is on Lauren's name and the Orisha, and the deep research that Octavia Butler did into naming. It's very, very intentional, especially with the more West African and specifically Nigerian names, that they are very purposeful, and those names contain the character for Doro, Anyanwu, for Lauren. I don't know how deep her knowledge, Octavia Butler's knowledge, was of the Ifa or the of the Orisha, but that
I can tell you that she participated in rituals with me, but not because she was a believer in that. Right. It was out of respect for my beliefs, but she did come and participate in. Ceremonies for ancestors, for my Egun. Now she is one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now she is one. I think there's some unexpected emotional that's happening. It's really lovely to be feeling that here with everybody. And thinking about her work.
I was going to say, speaking of Orishas, the one that I actually associate most closely with her is Obatala.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, I heard that. I will say that Obatala is in charge of people's heads and also is associated with mountains.
Wow.
Mountains. And I still have a Christmas card that Octavia gave me with a picture of Mount Rainier on it. She loved those mountains. Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking also about there's something that Robin Cost-Lewis said during the launch event for Radio Imagination in her remarks. She reminded us that Octavia Butler is the child of migration, of the Great Migration specifically. And I was thinking so much about the migration of stories and culture and ritual and spirituality in Octavia Butler's work, but also as part of her person. Her travels to Peru and, you know, kind of studying plants, like that knowledge gets kind of transplanted into her Los Angeles, as do all of these different figures from West Africa. And and there's always so much movement in all of her work. And I'm really stunned by the kind of, yeah, I guess it's like a kind of diasporic movement that happens in her work in a really effortless, it's not effortless because there's, if you you saw just a little bit in the slideshow of her writings, it's immense how much work that she's done. But there's this way that she also has migrated and moved through so many different cultures and beliefs and traditions and made a really dynamic space where they all kind of coexist and conflict, and that's community, that and that those are the kind of the seeds that we're constantly growing out of. And community is such a big part of her books and of her work. And whether it's there's always a mutual dependence, whether it's recognized or not.
whether it's wanted or
whether it's wanted, whether it's understood. And community is a big part of all of what you do, all of you, in different ways in your work and drawing people and ideas and traditions together, and creating access for people in those ways, in drawing people together. So I'm reading the Patternist, rereading the Patternist series. So I'm very much about the mind web right now and the way that Mary in particular is always drawing people into the pattern and drawing people to her, and creating these communities. And I think that's what she, Octavia Butler, did as a creative person, and seems to be perhaps also a great analog for what artists do, in a larger sense, artists, writers, scholars, in transmitting ideas and drawing people to them and then creating more expansive connections. And I wonder if we can just talk a little bit more about community and all of those kinds of connections that can be made.
If I can go out of turn and
please. There's no turn. You can do whatever you
and
want.
And just monopolize this microphone here. I gave a speech at a convention where I was a guest of honor, and I was talking about genius and how genius is an effect of community. My two examples were Michael Jackson and Octavia Butler. And though she was a loner, she still was giving expression to her community. I think that's probably all I have to say. I'm not taking up too much time.
I want to say, too, to kind of bring it back into the body, the aspects of community and movement and migration and all of those things, those come directly from her family history. First, she knew that her mother had at least four miscarriages, and at least one of them was a stillbirth, right? So she says in an interview with Ayana Rashida Abdullah that she was writing her community that she would have had her brother survived. And that's, you know, black male infant mortality statistics that have historically, that persist to this day, right? The disparity in like birth weights and birth defects and different things that happen to our boys. That's one thing. Another thing is that when you look at the census records in 1930, when her family migrated from Louisiana, you see that there's a whole gang of them, right? All of the siblings, her mother being the eldest sibling, and that she would give the census workers the information, probably because she could read and write, and she was ushering all of these younger siblings and their mother. They came here in 1930. So that's right from her family history, and I think she was drawing from that when she was writing those female heroes, because they came without the grandfather, right? It was just the siblings and the mother, and they came to California at that time together. So those are very practical, physical things. Like, we're thinking about it philosophically, but it was a practical matter of how is she going to feed all these kids? Where were they going to live? What work were they going to find? They were switching ages and saying that, people were doing things just to survive. And that's practical, real, when you could get killed, like something happening. Those stakes were existing in history, in her family history, and in our shared California history.
Yeah, the whole idea of the Western migration, I'm really digging deep on that because I'm a part of that. But I think there's a lot of similarities within the family structures, because let's say, like my father, my family traveled really pretty interestingly, because we had one woman by the name of Miss Prince that also traveled with two other men and did a trip that were migrant farm workers, and they did Mexico was part of it, Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, and Bakersfield. And that was the kind of following the the pattern of growing, the growing that took place. So the whole idea of, I have eight brothers and one sister, so it's big families. A lot of the families were big in those days because you could they could be used for fixing, you know, doing fill work, as I did. I worked in the fills and stuff. So the whole idea of the Southwest and who we are and the struggles that it's that we went through is something that I'm really drilling deep on, because I think the stories are really quite exciting. The idea of also the Orishas. I patterned my first film, I and I. It was the story of Aishka, who was the daughter of Oya, dealing with the idea of change. And so there's a lot of stuff to me that I saw that she was going through, that it seems like it's a kind of a Southwestern ethos of a sort, of a kind of a way to look at the world that seems to not be investigated yet. I think the Memphis one has, the New York ones have, Chicago has, you know, New Orleans, but I think there's a special story that that comes from all of us that are a part of this Western migration that I want to start drilling down on and seeing how we can expose that. And I think Octavia is helping me a lot in this right now, because seeing her patterns, that pattern maker, I like the fusion of nature. I like the way that it's making me even work nowadays, because I'm in a community of Leimert Park. And we're right now wanting to make the future now, because the future is hitting us really pretty fast right now. And so we're dealing with how can we make the future now. So I'm extending myself beyond filmmaking into other types of intersections on seeing how we can engage the future, but doing it with a lot of the things that I'm learning from rereading Octavia actually right now.
I mean, talking about, you know, personal history, and I remember reading an interview of Octavia where she talks about the single house that her blended family was living in, and how there was this structural idea of like, okay, everybody doesn't get along, but they have to, as a way of surviving, stay in this space. She talks about having great big uncles who, you know, sort of extended a kind of a barrier of a certain kind of protection in that neighborhood. But as this structure is all created by a matriarchal figure, and that idea of having to work together despite differences, it's as it's sort of resistance or allergy towards the idea of the utopia or the utopic. That the work, you know, and I was, you know, when you said like it's not effortless, I mean, the work that it takes to not, you know, to recognize and, you know, destruction both external and internal, and to work to defend against that is something that I found really interesting in thinking about that.
It's all through her work.
Absolutely, too. Yeah. The community, yeah, that has to, but even if they don't want to, but they have to.
And, you know, it's also striking, it moves me so much, that in a society that doesn't tend to value writers and artists very much at all, how strict Octavia Butler's upbringing, you know, seemed to have been, that her mother believed in her ability to be a writer and took it seriously as work, and as seriously as Octavia Butler, E. Butler, took it herself. Like, her mother bought her a typewriter, and, you know, they lost a very hard-earned $62 it's a lot of money, to an agent, because they didn't know, you don't pay up front for an agent to send your work out for you.
And the tremendous amount of support and belief in Octavia Butler. And it's not like she was sitting home writing. She had a job. Like, she went out and she worked. And she kept these intense hours. She'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to write before she went to work in a department store. And so I just, there's something with this, what we're talking about in terms of community and cooperation and the theme that runs through so much of Octavia Butler's work, not just about the ecology and topography of our physical space, but the ecology of people and how we actually feed off of and feed each other. And these households, it's actually... my mother wasn't super supportive of me being an artist. You got to do something else, and that's a hobby. So I was just kind of like, okay, for Octavia Butler, that could happen, that her mother's like, okay, I'll get you a typewriter. It doesn't matter what else other people say.
Yes and no, right? Because mm-hmm. she did bring home all the cast-off books, and she read to her every day until she was 6 years old, she says. Mm-hmm. But her ideal job for her would have been to not have to stand up and to work inside, right?
Right.
So maybe be a teacher or a nurse or something, which is what my grandmother was, right?
Right.
Not working for someone, earning a wage somewhere where she was not outside, which, you know, I like to say and remind us, like, we're sitting here, right? We're like our great-great-grandparents' dreams that they never imagined, right? Mm-hmm. That they never envisioned. Then we're here.
Adrienne Marie Brown and Walida Imarisha call that walking science fiction. we are walking science fiction.
But it's important to note also that Octavia Butler kind of did one better. You know, what her ultimate goal was to work for nobody but herself. You know, that she was her own boss.
Because she didn't suffer fools.
Did not. And we're pretty good. We have some time. But I'm thinking about migration and also integration. And not integration in the way that we talk about it, but I'm thinking so much about genre. We talk so much about Octavia Butler being the only black woman science fiction writer and how she kind of integrated a predominantly white and male science fiction realm. But I'm also thinking about what that meant within black literary traditions, to be working in a genre that, you know, for some time, and perhaps still now in some ways, is maybe less so now, but it's seen as kind of outside of the tradition. And we're all working in different ways that are outside of what might be perceived as our traditions in some ways, as innovative or experimental or avant-garde makers, as scholars who are also very invested in community-based practice and in the genre of sci-fi. And I wonder if, you know, like, what your thoughts are about this, the kinds of inroads Octavia Butler made for all of us to do work that isn't what is expected of us to do.
For me, it's a lot more freedom to operate outside of in the future, because it's not defined as of yet, and we can define what that means. So that's the freedom that it gives me, because you can go beyond the stereotypes and create your own world.
For me, it's the recognition that she received that is most freeing, the MacArthur Award. Because actually, I just did this whole timeline of the history of black science fiction. There were people writing science fiction that were black, that were women, over 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's just that they didn't necessarily get the kudos that she got. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. so that to me is what makes the difference. It's like, I can do that, and I can get money for it, and I can get recognition for it. And there's someone else that's gotten recognition so that my mother will understand that it is possible for me to be not just good at this, but understood to be good at it.
I mean, you know, for me, it's in it, the how it provides. Oh, most I'm late. I'm just like, yeah, I'm jumping in right here.
Why they're hugging?
Sit back.
They're hugging.
Sit back.
It's all timing.
It's all timing. Exactly. And the off timing as well. Right. I wanted to say quickly, like, two things about that. One, the kind of the way for me, Octavia Butler provided an entry point, right, into a kind of way of imagining the now, in one of its most frequently used disguises, which is the future, right? But also a destination point, that there is a kind of linking of so many, you know, imagined worlds, whether we're talking about Parliament's music, or whether we're talking about Deltron 3030, or whether we're talking about a verse from Erykah Badu, or whether we're talking, like, there are all of these other worlds, right? The Drexian, I mean, like, all of these different types of spaces. And the other thing that I think is about timing, actually, and one of the things that I think about a lot when we use the phrase radio imagination is the specifics of listening to the radio in the foothills of Altadena, which is that you drive and for a second you're hearing, like, you know, some old soul music or something, and then it the static, because of the geography, like, thrusts it into a completely different language or a particular different mode all in a second, and it moves and it blends and it morphs and it transforms. Just driving along Altadena Drive, you might hear three different radio stations without changing the dial when I was growing up. And so I have to think about that as a way of thinking of the notion of radio imagination, the way of thinking about change, the way of thinking about what that encounter means when you don't plan it. It doesn't matter if the song is at the point which you, that's your favorite moment of the song. Right? It doesn't come because you asked it to come. It comes because you're here at this moment. And so I think about that as a way of working through not only the question of community. Mm-hmm. Community is thrust upon you. Mm-hmm. You don't get to keep your car as this hermetic, you know, ego space. Unless you now have a tape player or, you know, like, at the time you didn't get to do that. And so I think that as a part of how I think of radio imagination conceptually and how it's, you know, connects community and my work and, you know, what Octavia Butler makes possible is very important.
And I like that as a way also of going back to what you said, Ayana, about intersectionality before we had that term. Like, you don't get to choose when these encounters and collisions occur. You know, you're not always ready for them. You know, you might be very comfortable in however you're thinking, and then there's something that makes you have to switch your attention and adjust to a sound or some meaning-making that sounds like noise that you have to kind of concentrate on to get to its music. And with that, since we're winding it down, but I'm going to make it. We have a little clip from Octavia that I'd like us to play as we shift into a speed round conversation about feminism and Octavia Butler.
I grew up with an almost what you would call a monkey on my back. I knew I wanted to write from age 10. I knew I wanted to write, but I had to write. It was like some kind of, I wrote an article called Positive Obsession for Essence Magazine. It was my positive obsession. Now, I began writing, I mentioned, when I was 10, and I began by doing something that most of the writing teachers tell you not to do. Every writing class I got into, from college onward, the teacher began by saying, write about what you know. Now, I'll tell you, I began writing at age 10 to get away from what I knew. What I knew was boring and dreary, and I hated it. At 12, I discovered science fiction. I had already been reading science fiction. I was raised in Pasadena, and the Pasadena Public Library was my first library home, and I read all the science fiction I could find there just because it was fun, even though the juvenile science fiction tended to be boys' books. I think part of the reason I wound up writing science fiction, there is a bigger reason, but part of the reason is I wanted to write the kind of science fiction I wasn't finding to read. And, you know, in boys' books, you definitely don't find yourself if you happen to be a little girl.
And so, feminism and Octavia Butler, specific to Los Angeles as well.
I'll take that. Excellent. Alex, I'll take, what is, I'm just kidding.
What is feminism and Octavia Butler for 500? Ayana?
It's not February anymore.
It's March. It's Women's Month.
It's perfect.
So that it's 1,000.
Yes. There are a couple of things that have come up. One of them is about being confronted with the other or some unplanned circumstance that incites you or like really sparks and like grabs your affect so that you have to react, whether it's good or bad, right? She writes that in her books, and sometimes when you're in the archives, like there's a letter to Gene Roddenberry, and it looks like she was watching Star Trek, there was a screwed up storyline, and she was like, let me find something to write on. She turned it over and started being like, dear Mr. Roddenberry, let me tell you, I've been watching your program, right? So she said she called herself a news junkie, right? Mm-hmm. So she was very much in the world, right? Talk about not being hermetically sealed. She was very much in the world and encountering people. And she had ideas. Somebody asked her in an interview, like some kind of morning, like Today Show or something, and said, oh, her and the other panelists, well, do you consider yourself a feminist? And the other people were like, well, no. Oh, you know, thank you for asking. And she said yes, right? She said yes unequivocally. There was no but. That was that. And this is before, when she was already realizing that the feminism that they were talking about was not the same one that she experienced, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't about being able to go into the workforce in the 1950s and have someone else come and scrub your floors, right? She knew that poor people and women of color had already been working all the time outside of the home. Right. And what were the strides that we could make beyond that, right? How could we imagine ourselves to be other than what was projected onto us? And that is what is that spark is in her writing, and then also the ways that your biology betrays what you really desire, right? And how you have conflicted feelings about yourself and what you desire on one level, but that you don't want to admit that you desire. That happens in the Xenogenesis Lilith Brood trilogy. And that's a real thing, right? Because in feminism, there's lots of conflicts, right? It's like, you see my ring, right? I'm married. We have a particular expectation of how things work in the family and who does the child rearing, and there are all these conflicts, right? But they can exist simultaneously. It's not either or. It's both and. It's not in the future or in the past. It's all of the above, which is why people call her the grandam of Afrofuturism, because there's so much going on. And Nisi made a point in another conversation about being in a community of writers, not just being in a community of writers that are her contemporaries or artists and filmmakers like you, but being in conversation with people that did not yet exist.
Mm. I said that?
More or less.
I think of her as a feminist in the ways, of course, in the ways that she had strong female characters in everything that I ever read by her. Not always strong female human characters, but yeah. And she had characters that were neither male nor female, characters that were both. She did a lot with gender. But she also did something that I probably will not be as articulate about describing, but she would... Negotiation and imperfection were...
pretty much the default for anything that she wrote. Anybody that was in any confrontation, there was nothing about overcoming someone. There was everything about adjusting and accommodating and working together. And help me now, I really think that that's a feminist value. I don't think that feminism is about, you know, women being greater than trans women. I don't think that it's about women beating up men or overcoming men. I think it's about getting along.
And with that, perhaps we should open it up to questions. There's a mic coming around.
Hi, everyone. It's really great to be here. I discovered Octavia Butler when I was 22. I just graduated college and was very lost. And like, she helped me kind of find my way a bit. And I started by reading Wild Seed, and then right after that, I read Mind of My Mind, and then Clay's Ark, which for me came out of nowhere a little bit. And then I found that there was another novel, and I don't know if it was before or after in the timeline, called Survivor. And I was wondering, I haven't read it, but I was wondering why she didn't like that particular book and why it didn't get republished, if you guys know.
We all know this.
Well, she felt that she sold the script too soon. She sold the manuscript too soon and that it needed some more edits. She sold it so she could get the advance and use the money to do the research for Kindred, because Kindred was pressing on her soul and it needed to be written. So she said, you know, I need some cash. Let me pull this already done one out of the drawer, and she sent it off. But then she felt like she thought it needed more work. It wasn't as perfect as she would have liked it to be, although many of us disagree with her, that it is the way that it's supposed to be.
And she insisted that her publisher never reprint that book.
I have a copy, and she inscribed it to me. Niecy, this is one of my books that I wish you didn't have.
But it's now in public domain, so everyone can read it on the internet.
That's right.
But maybe her estate will decide to reissue it, because I think people would love to be able to read it again, along with the Unexpected Stories kind of prequel short story that goes with it. It goes together beautifully. There's no human beings in the entire short story, but it's the most compelling thing that you can read.
Mm. And she's also, there's a number of occasional essays throughout her papers that, and I'm nowhere near done, there's a piece that she wrote about the second LA rebellion in 92, a piece about it's called The Cycles of Humiliation and Fear. She's an amazing no-nonsense essayist, clean, concise, direct, brief. And I would love to see those pieces
in a collection.
There's an incredible amount of material that we can still learn from.
There's also another question all the way over here in the back, too.
I have a quick question. When Octavia was here on stage, she had told me in advance that she wouldn't read her own work, but the interlocutor forgot and asked her to read something, which was when she said publicly, "I can't, I'm dyslexic." What do you know about the extent of her dyslexia? Because, you know, obviously the writing is so fluid, the notes are so fluid. What do we know about that disability? Does anyone know?
If anything, for me, I think I don't know what dyslexia actually is, because what I've encountered in reading through her papers are things that are so common to me. But this is me as a reader, not me as a person having the experience of being aware of. All I've encountered are misspellings for the most part, But yeah, like what her experience was looking at text, I can't account for in reading her text myself. So I don't know.
I just want to say I know that it was work for her to read and to write, but that might have helped her as a writer, because I know of three other Black science fiction writers who are dyslexic.
Chip,
Samuel R. Delaney, same person, Chip, Nalo Hopkinson, and Tobias Bekele.
And my ex-girlfriend who said, it's a sign of genius. So I believe that.
There are two kind of features that maybe point to some of this. And when you can see her early writing, like elementary school and her school papers and different things, and some of her early journals, she has this quirk of writing the letter T and the letter F like this, right? It kind of looks like a backwards pound sign. Mm-hmm. So
the British pound sign.
The British pound sign. Mm-hmm. So it's like the F and the T in her mind maybe were reversed, and so when she was moving quickly, she would write them in a particular way so that when you're reading aloud, then your eyes are not seeing, like some of the letters are sort of transposed in that way, but it's mostly that T and F thing that sort of forms an E, right, in a way. And the other remarkable thing is, dyslexia or no, there are some passages that she wrote out by hand in 1974 or 1975, and when you crack open the published book, it's the identical handwritten thing that she then typed up that then ended up being published. Like, whatever disability she had or did not have, she had some other extraordinary abilities that allowed her to do some things that most regular human beings
She worked really, really hard. I mean, it's staggering the amount of handwritten work there is that became those books.
Like word for word with the punctuation and capitalization and ellipses and everything. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So I think that's what I meant when I said I don't know, because what is it to live in language and to try to transcribe in these glyphs what's happening in your mind? How can that be done perfectly? Like, is there any such thing? You know, so in my encounters in reading her, I'm just astounded by how much she produced, how well she produced it, and how determined she was to get it done.
Right, and she didn't write any of her books on a computer until Parable of the Talents. So that was all handwritten and then typewritten and then rewritten, I mean retyped, right. Not word processed. So.
Next question, right over here.
Hi, I'd heard about Octavia forever, and finally a girlfriend of mine since I was like 12, she had finally gone back to school in her late 20s, and that's, you know, the best time to read is when you have classwork to do. Like, oh, I have a paper due. I think I'm going to go read a novel. So she had read Fledgling and then passed it on, and I was like, oh, this is it. And I devoured everything that I could find that she wrote in about 2 years, and I'm like on this mission that I'm still on to develop her work for the screen. And so one of my Octavia obsessions is the Parable series. And after I read Parable of the Talents, I felt like it was an incomplete series. And I went searching and searching and had read somewhere that it was. And so for the last, 5 or 7 years, I have been wondering, A, if she left extensive enough notes for someone to finish that project, and B, if that's possible. Because I know Robert Jordan did just that. He took 20 years to write his Wheel of Time series and died with 3 books left and left a list of writers for his wife. Like, have these people finish this, please? So, like, I'm wondering, you guys are reading her work, is there possibly some notes to finish this project that I yearn for?
Six at one point, and then she
yeah.
got it down.
There was supposed to be five books. Parable of the Teacher, Trickster, and Clay were the next three.
Right.
Teacher, Trickster.
But the books that happened at the end of her life when she was struggling with some, like, side effects from medications and different things, like, they don't they're not written in the same fluid way. So what she said was that she had some stories in her trunk when she wrote the pattern series, that those are the stories that she had been telling herself from childhood, and then she ended up publishing those, and that the next sets of books were much more difficult to write. And the writing that she did at the end of her life was rich, but it was harder to come by, and it took her much longer. So you can look up, like, Jerry Canavan has, like, sort of summarized what he found in there, but there's so many different versions and so many different ideas, I don't know that anyone could do them justice, no matter how brilliant, like, taking all of those things together and trying to weave one coherent narrative, because she hadn't
she
decided.
She was changing them.
Right. They were constantly changing.
Thank you all so much. The most interesting, I've never seen anybody write such exquisitely intricate child characters. And I'm wondering, or youth characters in particular, lots of the heroes are very, very young. And I was thinking of Fledgling, you know, Fledgling blew my mind. Can you, even though also very old, can you talk about age or age and character in her work and your experience? Is this just my own personal obsession?
Macy, do you have any thoughts about that? I have a few, but if you do.
Do you have any thoughts?
No? Okay. well, I've been thinking about that, and some of the things I've come across in her journals were comments from relatives and from teachers when she was young that she might be backwards or that she might not be very smart or that she might not, that something might be developmentally not sparking, which is ridiculous, but.
It's typical with genius, though.
Mm-hmm. You not recognize it. So in reading that, I didn't feel surprised that her protagonists would tend to be, some of them, would tend to be young coming into recognition, acceptance, and facility of their powers and how to use them. And I'm actually really kind of endeared to her for doing that repeatedly. Mary in Mind of My Mind is very young. A book that wasn't published, Blind Sight, has a protagonist, Aaron, who's quite young when he comes into his powers. Of course, Lauren in Parable of the Sower is like 15. Who else?
Akeen. Akeen? In Xenogenesis.
Oh, that's right, in Xenogenesis. So there's something in that seems quite important to imbue young people, and not imbue them, because young people do have extraordinary talents and powers that are often overlooked or misunderstood or denied, and we don't value some of the extraordinary developments that young people make. And so to kind of have those, and not only are those characters, some of those characters young, but they're also coming into their powers in such a way that they need to kind of understand what it might mean to be a god. So in speaking of change and transformation, there's always that element as well. What does it mean to have these extraordinary powers over other people? What does it mean to be a god? And that question is asked to have followers, to have faith, to have influence, all of those kinds of things, and that a very young person would be tasked with self-actualization and control and ethics and everything in leading scads of people. So it's quite interesting what she's doing and where she's putting power in a society where that's not the way things go.
And they're a biological site of change, right? Like that's
adolescence.
Like, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's unavoidable.
Right.
And the same care that she puts in the names is, you know, like the Dana being maimed. I mean, like, you know, like they are where change is immediately recognizable, unavoidable, and presumably a site where many of her readers would be familiar with that subjectivity, right? I guess I would say think.
And over here?
Really stunning panel, y'all. Ben, I'm glad you mentioned that you drove her once. I had a chance to chauffeur assist. We were in D.C. hosting her. And talk about a cool person just saying, you know, what's up? And I heard her say something that really connects what you just said, Tisa, is that she was not, she said we had to be aware as a species of a sort of calcified hierarchy. I sat in a room and heard her say that. I thought that was the most brilliant thing I heard in my life at that time, along with some I.E. Kwee Arma said about inspiration and manipulation. So I just want to celebrate this project because this is a sis I've been lucky enough to meet and read for a long time. So looking forward to seeing what gets up on the walls and gets into the room. I want y'all to come up out of the paperwork, which is, I'm super envious, to be honest, but that's a beautiful thing.
Thank you, and Tisa, thank you for a beautiful moderating. Thank you to our wonderful panel and to Julia. And
I'm going to be calling you that.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.